Accession number 25054, Real 1.
Derek Plummer, Real 1. Can you tell me first of all where you were born?
I can. I was born in a village called Hockcliffe, which is in Bedfordshire.
And what did your father do?
He was... worked in Luton, which in those days was a town with only had Vauxhalls, and everything else was devoted to hat manufacturing. And he inherited a fairly large hat manufacturing business, employing about 450 girl women, which suited him admirably. He bought the house we lived in, which is about 15 miles away, and disappeared every morning and came back in the evening. And eventually I got to know him. I was old enough, but that was in Bedfordshire, a dreary part of the world. But the village was very sweet.
And did your mother work?
No, she didn't.
Right. And did you have brothers and sisters?
I had a brother, and I've still got one. Right. He's a year and 3 months older than myself.
Uh-huh. And where did you go to school?
Bedford.
Uh-huh. And what age did you leave school?
17.
Mm-hmm. And what exams did you take?
I took, of course, school certificate and got sufficient credits to get into a sixth form. And the only other exam I took was the Civil Service Commission exam. But it's why the hell civil service? I don't know. It was a service. It was an examination opening entry into the Navy from public school. We went in. When we took the exam, I was 17 and a bit. And then at that level, we came into the senior term of Dartmouth cadets, who, of course, were the experts. But that was the way it was.
Did you take an interest in things military or naval?
Yes, I did, because we lived from what, the age of 7 onwards. My family, my father and mother divorced. My mother came from Dorset, and her father had an enormous estate in Dorset on the Piddle, the River Piddle. And if you look at the map, it's very close to Wool and Bovington with the tanks and Weymouth. And Weymouth, of course, was enormously naval in those days. Now it's just sort of full of tourists, buses and things from the north. But those days, Portland was one of the major naval bases. And so Weymouth itself was almost entirely Navy. And I was lucky enough to have a 12-foot clinker-built dinghy with sails, which I kept in the garden of a retired colonel, Colonel Jack Shute, who was colonel of the Dorsets. And he lived on a private road right over in the northeast corner of Weymouth Bay, which is called Bowley's Cove. And if you're interested in art, John Constable painted Weymouth from Bowley's Cove. A lousy beach, lots of stones and things. So it wasn't a temptation for anyone to go there, but it was a private beach as well, frightfully snobbish. And I trundled my dinghy down to the water at sort of 7:30, 7:45 in the morning, if I could persuade my mother to take me down. And left all the gear on the beach, got my little boat in the water, and if I timed it right, I could get right across Weymouth Bay to Portland, and I could be in time to watch the submarines and the destroyers going out for exercise. Every day they did it, except Saturday and Sunday. And I was absolutely mad about the Navy. But I was also thinking of going into medicine with a 2. And would you like me to tell you what decided me which was? I was one morning, it must have been 1938, 7 or 8. And I had seen the submarines come out of Portland Harbour and disappear over the horizon to the excise area. And I didn't see any the destroyers. We always went afterwards. They went faster. So I sailed across, and I saw all the destroyers were either alongside or up buoys. So I thought, well, hell, I'm not going to wait for that. I'll sail, do a bit of sailing and go over to Lulworth. And I had the whole day to myself, and suddenly I had that awful feeling that I was being followed. And I turned around, and there were 3 destroyers in line ahead doing something like 20, 22 knots, which is a hell of a speed. They kick up a lot of water. They have a huge wash. I nearly turned over. They shook all the wind out of my sails. But the third one, Tail End Charlie, the destroyer, stopped, turned right round me to create what is known as a slick. It's calm water. If you turn a complete circle, that bit is calm for a bit, and then it gets rough again. And when, by the time he'd finished his circle round me, the captain came to the side of the bridge with a loud hail, and he said, "I'm sorry about that. Are you all right?" And I said, "Thank you, sir, I am." He said, "Good, enjoy your day sailing. I must catch up with the rest of them." And away he went. And that destroyer was called Achates, A-C-H-A-T-E-S, Achates. She was one of the A-class destroyers, which was permanently, at that stage, permanently working from Portland on anti-submarine warfare. And I'm going to say this because I've got a chance to say it. If it hadn't been for the work done at Portland, forget the gunnery school and all the other people who were so, they thought they were the cat's whiskers, the work done at Portland between the two wars decided World War II. Had it not been there, had they not got all the expertise in anti-submarine warfare, the war could well have ended in 1942 when even Churchill said the only thing that ever frightened him was the U-boat. And they were just about on top of us then. Had it been, had we had no ASDICs and no expertise in sailing submarines, it would have been over by 42, 43. No doubt about it. So that was it. That's why I joined. So after that, I thought, Christ, here's a captain of a destroyer talking to me, a humble schoolboy. Forget medicine. I'm going straight into the Navy as soon as possible. And that was it. That's absolutely true.
No,
the crucial thing was that we had, they mastered the art, but had invented sonar, which we now call, so it was used to be called ASDICS, and I think ASDIC stood for Anti-Submarine Detection Investigation Committee. And we always called it ASDICS. It was only after the war it became sonar when we went American. And you see, no country in the world had it. We sold ASDICS to the Americans. They hadn't any idea. And it's interesting that at least 6 months before Pearl Harbor, we were working with American ships. No, put it the other way. The American ships were working with us. They came over to learn about convoys, which they didn't believe in. They had two teams of two or three in quite a number of our ships, destroyers, learning about sonar, ASDICS. And I think they made them under license in America. They had the better facilities than we did. And we sent teams over to America to teach them. Had it not been for us, they wouldn't know anything about it at all. So there.
So the schoolboy was now smitten with the glamour of the Navy. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. Yeah. I think glamour is a good word. Yes, it was. It seemed very glamorous indeed to me.
So when you left school, did your mother or your father have any particular plans for you?
No. I have always had my own
choice.
No choice. I just told, you see, they were separated. I didn't see very much of my father after the divorce, really. But my mother did what she was told. She was a very sweet woman, and she loved sailors. So I think she, as children, we used to be welcomed on board ships in Portland Harbour, providing her mother came along with them, because she was a very good-looking woman, divorced, and relatively young. She was as old as the years, so in 1939 she was 39. It's like the Queen Mum.
So you visited a lot of ships then?
We did, yes. My father was not the least bit interested, and if ever he could, he dropped out and said he wasn't the faintest bit interested in anything to do with the Navy.
So on leaving school then,
yes.
What did you actually do?
I took this examination I told you, the Civil Service Commission exam, which was equivalent to the then high school certificate. Three subjects, maths, English, and a subject of her own choice. And because I'd been working, thinking about medicine, I was, my choice was biology and botany. And I got into the Navy, my maths was pretty lousy, but they wanted 75% on each subject. And I just got about 76 in maths. I did fairly well in English. And I think in my biology, it was out of 400 marks. I dropped 4 marks, I think. It might have been 5. And that must have been for my appalling writing, which was designed to cover up my even worse spelling. So I think they dropped me. So I got in on biology. And it was as simple as that. It was a ridiculous exam. It was one of those exams when you really began to think there was something wrong. It was so easy. I was at least a year and a half ahead of. You know, in biology, you start with the amoeba, and then you go to the earthworm, and then cockroach, and then a frog, and then if you're really good, you go on to a dogfish, and finally you rip open rabbits, and you can. And this was almost back to amoeba, the examination. It was unbelievable. And of course, and I also draw, you see, draw and paint, so it's very easy for me.
Where do you actually go then?
The first letter I got was to say, congratulations, we'll be sending you a uniform list shortly, and that arrived, luckily, because Weymouth is such a wonderful naval base as it was then. There was a Gives there, so I opened an account with Gives, and I never shut it, and I owed them money the whole time I was in the Navy, as everybody else did. They lived on credit, and when I retired, I settled my bill, and I got a very nice letter thanking me for settling the bill. and then I got a letter saying we were going to the training cruiser, and then I got a letter saying the training cruiser had been withdrawn. That was Frobisher. Was being drawn because of the war. They were being given up training and being regunned, I assume. And finally, I got a letter to tell me to join a train which was going from Paddington down to Dartmouth. And all the others who had passed this exam and were successful had joined, were on the train. And I think the total number from the schools was about 25, which seems very small indeed. They were divided into executive, as we were then. They gave up the term after the war sometime. Executive cadet, engineer cadet, paymaster cadets, and Royal Marines. They took four more Royal Marines, 12 executive, I think it was 8 engineers, and 6, I think, of the paymasters, who are now, of course, supply and secretariat. And that looked pretty mean for a war. We hadn't been at war for a month. We were only sort of 8 months into a war, and I thought. But by the time we got down to Dartmouth, we found we were joined by Indians, a lot of Canadians, people from Pangbourne, Worcester, and there's another training ship, I can't remember what the other one was, and that just about doubled us. And I must have been about 50 in all, and we were marched from the, having crossed the river from the railway station to Dartmouth, who had fallen in outside the hotel there, and marched up through the town up to this beautiful college. Have you ever been to the college?
No.
Lovely. Absolutely beautiful. But I noticed, and we all noticed, that we were taken round to the tradesman's entrance at the back. There was always some feeling amongst us that we were treated as undesirables. So we hadn't been, we were all sixth formers in fairly large schools, and we were sort of case hardened. The Dartmouth cadets, we always called the Darts, were very soft somehow. They had been cocooned there and looked after, never allowed out. They sort of drink and women and smoking and things like that were completely anathema. They knew nothing about it. They all seemed, it's an awful thing to say, they always seemed terribly effeminate to us, and they hated us because we were allowed ashore, and on Saturdays and Sundays we could just disappear into the world, and as long as we came back. They were never allowed outside the college grounds at all. So there was this.
They were about the same age as you.
Yes, they start at this age, about 11, don't they? They are 12, 13, 14. But we slotted in with the senior term. But we never, and the whole time we were there, I never spoke to a single Dartmouth cadet. It was like that. They didn't speak to me. Yeah. But the interesting thing was that we were there for 12 months. That was the idea. Instead of being 12 months in the cruiser, we were going to be 12 months in Dartmouth. Having walked up the hill, marched up the hill, we were given a cup of tea. Then we spent 1 hour learning how to sling and then lash up and stow a hammock.
Really? That was the first thing.
The first thing, before anybody did anything with the store, we had to learn the hammock. And we had two wonderful chief petty officers telling us. We were split into two divisions, about 25 in each. And we had a super boat called Mocha White, who was exactly like a Happy, the Snow White's dwarf. He was the same size, shape, and disposition. And he kept on telling us we had to know how to slow up this blasted hammock, because a hammock properly lashed up would stay afloat for something like 20 hours. Therefore, it would save our life. Well, of course, Nelson believed that, and all those people in that time. But it was well out of date by the time we joined the Navy, because you can imagine the hammock's almost as big as a man. And you are a rating and a destroyer. And all you live two decks down, and you get to the other deck, up a ladder, longer deck, up a deck, and so on. Abandoned ship, all the blokes down below will grab a hammock, and they're huge, and they have sort of fight to get up the ladders.
What were they made of?
Canvas, the outside, and a sort of bedding inside. And then the blokes on top will go down trying to get the hammock. So there's complete deadlock. No one will get either up or down, and the whole lot of ship would drown just because somebody told them that you could stay afloat with a hammock for 20 hours. I never saw a hammock in the water anywhere. And I saw one or two ships go down.
And I think they'd get sodden, wouldn't they?
Yes, they would, but they maintain they would hold you up. And then the chap in charge of us, the officer in charge, whose name was Pedder, Lieutenant Commander Pedder, we went out to our sort of servants' quarters. There was a large room with a stage, which with a curtain. The curtain was drawn back, chairs were put out, we sat down, and Pedder came in and lost a little bit of sense, and he told us, he introduced us to the staff, and he said, now, the syllabus is not going to be changed, but the time here is going to be changed. Instead of 12 months, you're going to do 3 months. So he said, it just means you've got to work four times as hard. And we did. Believe it, we didn't know anything like that we should have done, I'm sure, and they made an enormous allowance for it. But it was very hard work. But
the war had been going on for some months now.
Yes.
Have you been following the
Yes, indeed,
progress?
Yes.
Were you keen to get in there?
Yes, yes. I mean, to be told that we were going to be 9 months earlier at sea was the best thing of the lot. I mean, it was absolutely marvelous. And one of our two chief petty officers, Knocker White, was Snow White's man, but the other one was a chief yeoman of Signals Beach, his name was, chief yeoman of Signals Beach, and he'd just been in Exeter. And Exeter was in the Battle of the River Plate with the flag of there, and he was our immediate contact with real war.
Yeah.
And he happened to be an extremely good petty officer, chief petty officer, wonderful man.
Did he say anything that you can remember about that
battle? No, he didn't say anything. He'd never talk about it. But the silly part was, I hope I'm not wasting time, the chief gunner's mate is as near in the Navy as you can get to an arch bastard. He's got to be, otherwise he can't be a chief gunner's mate. He's got to frighten the life out of everybody, including officers. He's a chief petty officer in the gunnery branch. A chief yeoman of signals has no need to be like that. He's usually on his own with a few signal ratings on this flag deck and is always intelligent, polite, and efficient. And the roles were reversed with these two. Knocker White was almost like your grandmother, super bloke. He laughed, he talked, he never shouted at anyone. There was little discipline in him. He must have been the lousiest chief gunner's mate of all time, but he's such a nice bloke. Beach, on the other hand, was an absolute terror, but always had this hint of a smile on his lips when he was shouting at you. And they were two excellent people, but the roles were reversed. They should have been the other way around.
Was there an atmosphere of a public school there? It's only a bit like that.
Yes, very much so. And I think that was the best part of it. They were all from the larger public schools, and we had an awful lot in common. And it was interesting to see how the Canadians and the Indians and the South Africans treated us, because they always thought we were very cliquish. But I suppose we were. It's a pity. But the Canadians were wonderful. It was super.
What was the accommodation like?
Well, two large, I suppose you call them dormitories, but you see no bed, because we had the hammocks we had to sleep every night and lash up and stow in case the ship was sunk next morning. So I think there were 25 in each room. We were divided into two, as I said, two divisions. It might have been port and starboard, it could have been anything you like. And we had an officer looking after each of us, and both were young lieutenants of the engineering department branch. Why engineering? I can't think. One was called Bloomer, and Lieutenant Bloomer was terribly pleased with Lieutenant Bloomer. He was also a very happy man, so he had lots to say, all about himself. And he took the other division. My division was taken by one of his same term, I suppose, as a young engineer lieutenant, and his name was Pearsall. And Pearsall found it very, he was very quiet, a shy man, and I think he found it very difficult to cope with 25 fairly, 25 ex-6 formers and people like that. He found it was too much for him. So it was a pity. I think Bloomer was the better of the two. And there was no competition between them, but that was the way we were taught. The total staff was two chief petty officers, a warrant officer, Reggie Woodford, who was brilliant, Pedder, lieutenant commander in charge, the two engineers. And Petter had a winger who was another lieutenant commander, and I think his name was Blomfield. It sounds right, but it could have been different. And he was had been, quite obviously, a playboy. He was desperately good-looking. He also had a hell of a good-looking wife. And he was so sick at sea that he told us that he had to be carried up to the bridge at times. But his interesting story was that he was in Hood when she, in 1922, when she did the world cruise right around the world. And not only just to the ports of the empire, but to all foreign ports as well. And he took on that cruise, which lasted nearly a year, Edward VII, when he was Prince of Wales. And all, Bloomfield never taught us anything. We had a period with him. He would tell us yet another unlikely story about one of the episodes in this world cruise. And he was so funny. He was wonderful to listen to. I learned nothing except that the Navy could be great fun. So that was two lieutenant commanders. And there was the other one was an instructor, Lieutenant Commander Hughes. Absolute gem. Work stopped at, let's say, 5 o'clock in the evening. We then had a meal. And many of us went back to one of the two classrooms there to go through some stuff we didn't understand. And he would appear, and he'd stay there till 10 o'clock at night with us. He was wonderful, absolutely marvelous. We had an enormous syllabus to get through. I mean, none of us had touched spherical trigonometry. I mean, I can't even spell it now. I've forgotten what it was. And he was the patience itself, wonderful.
So you were all very keen to learn, were you?
Oh, yes, because our future depended upon it.
Right, right. So you were all very, in a sense, career-minded.
Yes, I suppose so. I suppose so. The first thing seemed to get to sea, and then to start, you know, trying to improve and impress other people, senior people, that you were worth promotion.
Right. So, what about your timetable at Dartmouth then? And what time did they get you up in the morning?
Oh God, up at oh Christ, double hour. It was about fairly early, about 5:30, 5:45, and before breakfast we split two ways. One lot went down to the water, to the Dart, and did sailing, and the others stayed up on the quarterdeck, the parade ground, not the quarterdeck, which is a lovely parade ground, right in the front of the college, and we did signals with Chief Yeoman of Signals Beach, divided into little groups. A group of eight was a flotilla of destroyers. Each of us had a little flag in our hand, and he would shout the orders, not saying turn left, but he'd tell you what flag he was flying, and then you put your hand up while he was telling you the next movement, and then you dropped your hand if you understood it. So you can imagine when everybody finally put their hand down, hoping they got the right thing, and then he said execute the order, everybody turned in a different direction. Eventually we learned how to the signals. It was great fun.
It
was just signals with flags. Oh, we did semaphore and Morse at other times, but most of the time in the morning we were learning these wretched flags, which you never use at sea at all.
So that would be before breakfast?
That was before breakfast, then breakfast, and then we worked through till, I don't know, I suppose 12:45, something like that.
Doing what? Is this classroom?
Mostly in navigation. Navigation and pilotage was the main thing. That was the only classroom thing we did was navigation and pilotage with Lieutenant Commander Hughes.
And what did he teach you in navigation? It's a big subject.
It's a huge subject. Have to learn, to begin with, the chart and all the signs on the chart. And then a subject I never understood, how the charts are actually made. A Mercator's chart is the Navy. And so you have to learn a little bit about spherical trigonometry to do that. And that came. It was copious notes, learning about having mastered the chart. And then, of course, you've got to learn about a sextant. So we had sextant. We'd go outside, having learned about sextant, how to take it to pieces, how to put it together again, and then go out and try and see if you could work a sextant. And all the time, also the pilotage, which is really navigation in sort of closed waters, going up and down a river, entering harbour, that's pilotage. Outside.
What is there to learn there? Are you not just reading a chart? Forgive my question.
What is learn? I suppose the most important thing is the rule of the road, which to recognise port and starboard buoys, to recognise all the things. I don't know what is. I mean, how do you get up the Thames? You get a pilot, is one way of doing it. The other way is to do it yourself and claim the pilotage. They used to pay you for pilotage. if you didn't employ a pilot. If you went aground, of course, it would cost you more than that. But it's difficult to say. Pilotage is purely and simply in harbours and the proximity of harbours. In other words, away out of the sight of land, it becomes navigation, I suppose.
And how did you do it all these things?
How did I do it?
Did you cope with it all? Because it sounds quite intense.
Yes. I think we all coped, some better than others. I had a brain which could assimilate, collect information. If I'd been to a crammer, I could have come out after a fortnight speaking Russian. If 2 days afterwards, I'd forgotten everything. Nothing stuck. There's a dirty great hole in my memory, which it all seeps out pretty quickly. One of the my particular friends, who's still alive, a guy called Dick Slaughter, he was one of the cadets there. He'd been head boy of a small school in Somerset, at a place called Bruden. What the school is, I don't know. I can't remember. His father was the largest farmer in the Falkland Islands. They had a very nice house in Staunton-on-Wye near Hereford, because I stayed there once or twice. He had a very nice sister who was in the WAFs. Dick had an uncle at Torquay, and it wasn't Torquay, I can't think of the name of the place, this side of Torquay, who had a huge hotel. And on Saturdays and Sundays, unlike the Dartmouth cadets, we were allowed ashore, and we used to go over to the hotel, four of us. And if it was raining, we'd sit. He gave us lunch free. We had to buy our own drinks. And we stayed the whole day there, all afternoon and evening, went back in the evening back to the college. And we took with us the problems that we'd met during the week, each one having different problems. And we'd discuss it and hear the other people's answers. And it was wonderful how these sort of things work. We'd just listen to each other, talking, until everyone was happy. All the problems they had are now being cleared up. And so that was useful.
You're very conscientious.
Very.
Yeah.
Well,
determined to succeed.
Yes, yes. Well, what was the alternative?
Well, a lot of military training seems to be something that was endured and you had to
Get
by. But
yes.
You seem to have.
This is the Navy.
Yes. Yeah.
We were very enthusiastic, yeah. Very. Yeah.
So, what about, did you go out into Dartmouth at all in the evenings? Or?
Yes, to the pubs. There was, if you go to Dartmouth, you come out of the college and you go down a hill and it's all landscaped, mostly rhododendron and things like that. Beautiful. And there's a huge gate, and opposite the gate, the other side, very close, there's a pub. And the pub is on the water, and the water, that part, is where the ferry comes across, and it's a floating bridge. Goes over the other side, coming all the time, backs and forwards. And the pub is called the Floating Bridge. And so that was the easy one. And yes, we went down there to learn to drink, I think. I won't tell you how much I learned to drink there. Not that I ever fell for drink, but I learned a very disgusting habit. And you could win money. People would say, I bet you can't drink a pint of beer without swallowing. That was the bet. And I learned how to do it. And it was my downfall as a midshipman, because someone at a party in the gunroom, we had a huge party one evening, and someone said, you should see Derek, he can do this trick, can drink without swallowing. So it just goes straight on. It's messy business until you've learned how to do it. And he said, but you've got to do it with a screw-top bottle, not in a jar, not in a screw-top bottle of Worthington. And I said, I'll try. And I got about a third the way through it, and I swallowed. Then you taste. And it was full of whiskey. It wasn't there at all. I was in sick bay for 3 days. Alcoholic poisoning. Mm-hmm. So I never tried it again.
Very wise. Derek Plummer, end of reel one.